the former head of Israeli military intelligence. Yehud also coordinated with one of Israel's three national institutions, the United Jewish Israel Appeal. The UJIA has hosted a school tour for the supposedly anti-occupation organization Yehud. Interestingly, while Yehud claims to oppose settlements, its helpful partner, UJIA, has been found to take British citizens for overnight stays in illegal Israeli settlements on tours of occupied Palestine. The links between Yehud and the UJIA do not end there. The chair of Yehud, Simon Sadie, was previously the founding chair of the UJIA business division. That doesn't sound very anti-occupation to me. Another interesting connection between Yehud and the illegal settlements that it claims to oppose is in its funding. The Peirce Foundation finances Yehud, which is not surprising, as Hannah Weisfeld, a former consultant to the Peirce Foundation, is now the director of Yehud. How cozy! What is less known is the Peirce Foundation funds the Hebrew University in occupied Al-Quds, which takes students from Oxford University to stay in the illegal French Hill settlements. The Peirce Foundation is also invested in a plethora of other Zionist pro-occupation organizations. The only difference is that Yehud masquerades as anti-occupation.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. And he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyam University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our expert guest today is Mick Napier. Mick is a lifelong anti-racist socialist and a veteran campaigner for Palestinian liberation. He's the secretary of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he's led many successful campaigns against the Zionist lobby. His effective advocacy for the Palestinian cause saw Zionists resort to lawfare tactics in order to close him down. But their mendacious legal manoeuvrings backfired, and Mick left the courtrooms victorious, and is now the only Scot certified free of racism by two Scottish courts. Welcome to the show. David, Yacab claims to be anti-occupation, yet it's closely linked, isn't it, with Israeli intelligence agencies, and regularly invites former heads of the agencies to address it. I mean, it seems like a severe case of cognitive dissonance to me. I mean, I don't know if it does to you.
Well, yes, it does. But this is, of course, the left face of Zionism, isn't it? It says it's anti-occupation, but by which it means the occupation from 67 onwards. They don't mean the 48 occupation. No. They mean a particular part of the occupation. And they think that if we just got rid of the occupation in the West Bank, things would be fine. We'd result in some kind of two-state solution, which, of course, is never going to happen
and
wouldn't work. So it's cognitive dissonance in the sense that there is giving a left-faced Zionism to try and recruit people to the idea that we can just be a little bit critical of Zionism in Israel and that will be enough. But it won't. And of course, that's the problem. Is that these people come into the movement and they try and divert the movement away from more fundamental and workable solutions to the problem of Palestine.
Indeed. I mean, Mick, do you think David's being unfair there?
No, if you're going to campaign for Palestinian liberation, you have to stand on solid ground. I remember started a couple of decades ago, people would say, look, we support the campaign for Palestinian rights, but don't raise the issue of refugees' right of return. It's too radical. Just concentrate on the West Bank. And so you find people who really see the horror of what's happening in Palestine, but they're not really prepared to break with the sort of confines of British foreign policy. I don't think it's been unfair at all. We have to be alert to people who will let us down at a crucial juncture. And I think part of the story today is precisely about that. We can face the likes of the open advocates of Israeli ethnic cleansing. We can face them down. We don't have any surprises in store. They've got a very poor hand of cards to play. We always win. The problem is the people who claim to support Palestine, but they'll come at you from left field, and that can sometimes be a little bit damaging. So, no, I don't think he's too hard. I think we have to get our defences up.
Mm. Well, David, I mean, what can you say about Ella Rose, who's a former board member of Yacab, isn't she?
Yes, this is, of course, the woman who famously in the Al Jazeera documentary threatened Jackie Walker with a bit of physical violence. She said, of course, I've got Krav Maga training, which, of course, is the Israeli overseen military training, which, is, of course, was used by American policemen, including those who killed George Floyd, let's remember. And, of course, she went on then to work for the JLM, the Jewish Labour Movement, and she has on her LinkedIn page, doesn't she, that she worked in an embassy of an undisclosed country, which, of course, means the Israeli embassy, which she used to admit to before she was exposed as being a full-time Israel lobbyist. So, unsurprisingly, someone like who's been in Yachad also has all sorts of other connections with the Zionist movement, not with the left face of the Zionist movement, but with the full-throated Zionist lobby, i.e. with the embassy itself, as you can see there with her, with the former ambassador,
Mark Regev,
yes.
Yes, indeed. I mean, and that documentary referred to is the Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, isn't it?
That's
people
right,
want to.
Yeah, I mean, key documentary, yeah.
Yes, indeed. 2017, I think, it came out, didn't it? People want to look that up. But, Mick, I mean, can you tell us about the Board of Deputies, which Jacob is a member of?
Well, yes. I was really privileged to be at a tribunal where Stephen Sizer, Anglican priest, was defending himself against charges of anti-Semitism. And the president of the Board of Trade came to give evidence. She said, we represent the Jewish community in Britain. We are totally inclusive. When the QC, at that time a KC now, when the QC cross-examined her and said, what about Jewish Voice for Peace? Oh, we don't allow them. What about Netarai Karta? Oh, not those renegades. And went through a list of Jewish groups, very substantial groups of Orthodox and Haredim, who were not affiliated to the Board of Deputies. And she was left absolutely wordless. The claims to represent the totality of British Jews or anything near it are completely false, but nonetheless, they are made repeatedly. They are a hit squad for the Zionist project. The arm in Scotland is called the Scottish Council of Jewish Communities, and they used to pretend that they were not Zionist. They used to, when challenged about support for Israeli war crimes, they would say things like, well, we have a range of views, not everybody supports Israel. Now they've come out as open advocates for Israel. They've made progress at the upper echelons of the Scottish government, very cosy and very unprofessional relations with the prosecution service, which I, through a freedom of information, we were able to see. And they actually persuaded the chief Scottish legal officer to, not the current one, but one back, to go to the Israeli embassy and have discussions with an Israeli legal figure from the embassy on the two countries' prosecutorial systems. Yeah. Now, what on earth is anybody doing discussing the prosecutorial system of Israel, which has a 99.7% conviction rate for Palestinians in the West Bank? Yeah. I hope the Scottish prosecutor wasn't trying to learn from that. It was absolutely outrageous. So they are in Scotland and across the UK openly Zionist. They work very hard indeed to silence pro-Palestine voices. And David, in your studio, is obviously one of them. But they were reduced to almost crying when it came to cross-examination, because what they said simply didn't stand up.
No, indeed. And of course, the Board of Deputies routinely weaponise anti-Semitism, don't they? But David, I mean, this organisation, the UJIA, I mean, how close is it to the Zionist regime?
Well, it's referred to in the video there as being one of the national institutions. No, it's the UK branch of one of the four national institutions in Israel, which is called Keren Hesod. It's Israeli headquarters. And as you can tell in the name, they're called the Israeli National Institutions because they're sort of quasi-state bodies. Yeah. And so they're part of the Israeli state, and they're part of the key part of Israeli foreign policy and objectives. The UJIA, in particular, one of the four, there's four of them, has the responsibility for fundraising for Israel. And, of course, it disperses funds all over the UK and indeed in Palestine and indeed in the occupied part, the illegally occupied parts of the West Bank, in order to support indoctrination into Zionism. They fund schools, even nurseries, to indoctrinate kids into Zionism from the age of four, for example. So there's a huge amount of activity going on there, and they're a charity, but nevertheless they are dedicated to pursuing the interests of the Zionist state.
Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after this report, which lifts the lid on the links between the PEARS Foundation, the New Israel Fund and Yachad UK.
A key funder of Yachad UK is the PEARS Foundation, which also provides the core office cost of the New Israel Fund in Kentish Town, London. Interestingly, the New Israel Fund shares that very same address with Yachad UK. The New Israel Fund, like Yachad UK, claims to be a progressive organization, but according to its guidelines, it explicitly refuses to support any organization that is anti-Zionist or even just pro-BDS. The NIF is also clear that it firmly opposes attempts to prosecute Israeli officials in foreign courts. It seems to be an arm of the Israeli Labour Party and is currently heavily invested in several organizations working to bring down the Netanyahu government, a goal shared by Israeli intelligence services as exposed by classified Pentagon documents. The Pearce Foundation, which funds both the NIF and Yachad UK, was founded by Israel lobbyist Trevor Pearce. He's a Conservative Party donor who was also on the boards of the lobby groups BICOM and the Conservative Friends of Israel. The Pearce Foundation has also been deeply involved with the British Council, where it funded an anti-BDS program called Britain-Israel Research and Academic Exchange Partnership, which was launched by the Israeli and British Prime Ministers. The Director of Leadership and Learning at the Pearce Foundation is Shoshana Boyd-Geffland, who previously was Vice President of the Wexner Heritage Foundation. In 2016, the Israeli regime listed the Wexner Foundation on a list of public sector reserve programs organized directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The Pearce Foundation also funded two operations we previously exposed to have a significant pro-Israel orientation, the Bradford Literature Festival and Forward Thinking. This corner of operations may be many things, but anti-occupation, it surely isn't.
David, tell us a bit more about this PEARS Foundation.
So the PEARS Foundation sort of poses as a kind of liberal pro-Israel foundation. It's one of the biggest Zionist family foundations in the country. There are probably about 150 or 200 Zionist family foundations. The biggest 100 of them have significant funds, up to a million and many times over £1 million a year. And PEARS is one of the top ones of those, maybe the top five of the Zionist family foundations. And it gives to a huge variety of Zionist causes. And you can see that on our website, Powerbase, where we list all of the different organizations that it funds. Now, it funds some liberal organizations. It funds the organizations we've been seeing there, Yachad, for example, but it also funds some quite extreme Zionist organizations. The way in which it operates is to infiltrate elements of British society. You saw the example there of the British Council, but of course also what it's done is funded the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Semitism, which on the face of it seems like a kind of, you know, all-party, cross-party examination of anti-Semitism in the society. But of course, what it really is doing is pursuing the Israeli government's foreign policy objectives, and it has been since the very beginning of the foundation of the APPG, and Pearce has been latterly a key funder of that. And of course, that's one of the key venues for merging together this notion that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are the same thing, which of course they're not. So Trevor Pearce's foundation has been at the forefront of pursuing this and colonising political space in the UK and making sure that there's no political decision-making body in the UK which actually have an independent view of what's happening in Palestine.
Indeed. Mick, British complicity with Israel seems to be endless, doesn't it? I mean, it seems, David's touching on it there, the British Council has an anti-BDS programme. I mean, does that surprise you?
Not at all. Can I add a little bit to what David has just said there, Chris? A very interesting footnote. The All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Semitism commissioned a report by an Oxford academic. I can supply his name afterwards. I forget it at the moment. And it was on anti-Semitism and the anti-movement. And he produced this report. Some of it's innocuous, some of it's banal and boring. But he actually said that it's really not acceptable to talk about blood. It's not acceptable. You can talk to some degree about the killing of children, but don't go on about it. Don't bang on about it, because that's anti-Semitic. This is because talking about blood, still, this is an Oxford academic, I kid you not, it's an appendix to the APPG website. This is because if you talk about Israelis killing lots of Palestinians, spilling blood and children's blood, this evokes memories of a medieval anti-Jewish libel called the blood libel, and it makes Jews feel very, very uncomfortable. So don't raise it. Now, why is this interesting? Because I was on trial once for anti-Semitism, and I didn't realise it at the time. I made the connection later. The crime of anti-Semitism in my and one other guy's case was precisely to allude to blood. It was 2 weeks after Operation Protective Edge. 2,200 Palestinians had been slaughtered, and we had a blood symbol on our placard. And in court, the procurator fiscal insisted that was a sly allusion to the medieval blood libel. And I found out later, in court, was I was reading from this report by the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Semitism. So you can get a measure of the validity of their notion of anti-Semitism, because they actually say, don't talk too much about Palestinian blood. It upsets Jews.
And as for British complicity, I mean, you know, with Israel, I mean, you know, and the British Council and its anti-BDS stance, I mean, I guess that doesn't surprise you. I mean, which was my original question before you added the footnote to David's previous response.
Chris, it's full spectrum. It's military, it's sniper rifle parts to the Israeli military while they were mowing down Palestinians in the Great March of Return. Yeah. It's political, it's diplomatic, it's economic. It's setting up government bodies precisely to defeat BDS by stimulating trade with Israel. Mm. One of the flagship projects has given us military grade surveillance systems from Israel, now deployed in Glasgow city centre. And of course, it also operates at the level of institutions like trade unions and the British Council and so on. Cool. The Zionists don't leave anything to chance. No. And I think what's really key, and what shed a light on the stuff about Yachad and how the various foundations appeal, one of the key strategies of the Israeli anti-BDS campaign is to divide the so-called extremists, those who consider Israel to be an apartheid state, who support BDS, with those people who voice criticisms of Israel. But Israel realizes they can't snuff out all criticism. So it's divide, just as they've operated across the Middle East in Britain. It's divide and set the so-called radicals like you from the so-called moderates, those who accept Israeli apartheid inside 48, and so on and so on.
Yeah. No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, tell us about Trevor Pears. I mean, he's got a strong relationship with the Conservative Party and the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre, otherwise referred to as BICOM, hasn't he?
Yes, so this is a Conservative Party donor, although, of course, he gives to these kind of notionally left-wing or liberal causes as well. And, of course, heavily involved in BICOM, which is the key PR agency for Israel inside the UK, funded and set up by a Finnish billionaire called Zablodovich, and appears to be one of the key donors to that. They've had several large ongoing donors from Zionist family foundations, which we've been discussing a minute ago. So he's a key player in the Zionist lobby in this country. That, of course, is how it operates. The Zionist lobby, you know, takes messages and and direction from Tel Aviv, but much of the money, most of the money really comes from Zionist foundations within the country. So you have the formal Zionist organizations, and then you have the kind of Israel lobby groups, the BICOMs, the Jewish Leadership Council, the Community Security Trust, and all of those are largely funded from Zionist family foundations. That's the immensely rich Zionists who start foundations with the proceeds of their business operations. And then they use that to infiltrate all sorts of areas of British political life. Mm-hmm. I mean, as Mick has been saying, the full spectrum, from economic life to cultural life to organisations like the British Council, which used to be, historically, the British Council is a British propaganda organisation. Mm. But now it's effectively an Israeli propaganda organisation, which is pretty extraordinary, really. I mean, you wouldn't expect a kind of a fading imperial state like the UK to be simply taken over by what we should now call, I guess, a rising imperial state, which is the Zionist entity in occupied Palestine. So it's an indication, really, of the way in which this whole thing works. Money is key to it. And again, this is one like Mick's been saying, you can't mention blood, you can't mention money either, because that also relates to some kind of medieval trope whereby Jews are said to have money. Well, actually, in fact, Zionists are a key part of the economic infrastructure of this country. Yeah. And Jews in the country only 0.5% of the population. But if you look at the top billionaires, 20% of billionaires in this country are Jewish in origin, and every one of them a Zionist. Now, that's the way in which this works. So they're actually part of the structure and economic privilege in this country, and that allows them access to a whole range of things that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. And that's why there's not, of course, access to for Palestinians or for Muslims in the same sort of way.
Well, it's quite an extraordinary tale, isn't it? But unfortunately, we are out of time again. So that's it for today. I want to thank our guest, Mick Napier, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified's made a lot of powerful enemies because we're exposing the reality of the Israeli regime's brutal oppression of the Palestinian people. And we're smoking out the clandestine and illegitimate activities of their apologists. The show's even been raised in the British Parliament in an attempt to close us down. So help us to beat our antagonists. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Najat. Please stay tuned.
امام عاص علیه السلام میدانید علی ابن مهزیار چرا
امام المهدی جل الله in a conversation with Ali ibn Mahziyar told him
Do you know why so many people miss the chance of visiting their Imam of the age? Because they amassed unlawful wealth and they were cruel and boastful to the oppressed ones and needy ones among the believers. Allah loves the believing people who are oppressed in this world. Imam al-Mahdi states, if you cut your ties with the poor and needy but faithful Muslims of your community, you will lose the chance of visiting me. The poor and needy faithful people among the Muslim community are very much dear in the eyes of Allah. In a narration we read that the oppressed faithful Muslims will enter paradise 500 years sooner than the rich ones. Allah will face such people on the Day of Judgment and tell them, O my dear ones, you were not given much in the world, but I reserved much for you here in the other world. So go and search for those who help you in the world and take their hands and bring them to the paradise. This is how Allah and Imam al-Mahdi will help us through helping the needy ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The U.S. military has claimed that it has permission to arrest people without charge and only on basis of being a suspect, to keep prisoners in detention indefinitely, particularly at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times has covered this story and tells us more. A human rights panel of the United States has demanded the immediate release of Guantanamo prisoner Abu Zubaydah, who has been tortured by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention urged the United States to release Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, from the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which is based within a U.S. Navy military base at Guantanamo Bay. The notorious prison was established by then-U.S. President George W. Bush in 2002 to hold foreign terrorism suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks in New York. Abu Zubaydah, now 52 years old, was captured in a raid in Pakistan just 2 months after the establishment of Guantanamo Bay Detention Camp and has been held there without charge since 2006. He is the first detainee to be waterboarded by the CIA after the 9/11 events. The United Nations panel said that after studying other cases at Guantanamo over the past 15 years, it had seen a pattern that could constitute crimes against humanity. Washington claims that although Abu Zubaydah, born in Saudi Arabia, was never a member of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group, he has been held indefinitely in the so-called war against terrorism because he allegedly helped militants reach Afghanistan for training before the 9/11 attacks. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which has no enforcement mechanism, also found that Abu Zubaydah had been denied a meaningful review of his detention and hence was being held against the law. The United Nations panel said in an opinion, the appropriate remedy would be to release Mr. Zubaydah immediately and accord him an enforceable right to compensation and other reparations in accordance with international law. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the same story and tells us more. Abu Zubaydah was the first prisoner of a CIA black site, a global network of overseas secret prisons that held over 100 men beyond the reach of US law and the International Committee of the Red Cross from 2002 through to 2006. Two CIA contract psychologists devised a torture program of enhanced interrogation techniques specifically for use on him in an agency prison in Thailand, in which he was waterboarded, deprived of sleep, and confined in a coffin-like box. The panel said, in July of 2002, the Central Intelligence Agency acquired approval for the use of 10 enhanced interrogation techniques on Mr. Abu Zubaydah: attention grasp, walling, facial hold, insult slap, cramped confinement, exacerbating phobias, wall standing, stress positions, prolonged sleep deprivation, and a waterboard technique. It added that the torturers reportedly subjected Abu Zubaydah to ice baths, forced nudity, and sexual violence. Methods were tested on him that had never been discussed. The panel also lambasted 5 other countries where the US held Abu Zubaydah, that is, Afghanistan, Thailand, Poland, Morocco, and Lithuania. In 2018, the European Court of Human Rights condemned Lithuania and Romania for their complicity in the CIA torture program. The United Nations also censured the complicity of the United Kingdom, whose spy agencies had US interrogators question Abu Zubaydah at black sites despite its knowledge of his extreme mistreatment. Back in 2019, Abu Zubaydah drew some sketches of how he was tortured. His lawyers made the sketches public, triggering an outcry from human rights groups across the world. The infamous US military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which was supposed to be a temporary detention center and never meant to be a permanent prison, was chosen because of its ambiguous legal status. It is under full control of the US military and relatively close to the mainland United States, but beyond the reach of American courts, thus allowing detainees to be held indefinitely outside of normal laws or judicial oversight. The English website of Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. The International Committee of the Red Cross has unveiled foreign inmates who had been held captive for many years without trial in the US military prison and torture facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba are showing signs of accelerated aging. The International Committee of the Red Cross's head of delegation for the United States and Canada, Patrick Hamilton, said, "We're calling on the US administration and Congress to work together to find adequate and sustainable solutions to address these issues." Patrick Hamilton added, "Action should be taken as a matter of priority." Most of the violations at Guantanamo were attested by numerous US military officers appointed to represent the inmates in courts of law, with very limited access to legal resources and classified documents to adequately defend the inmates or make a legal case against US military and spy agencies involved in the illegal capture and imprisonment of most of the captives held at Guantanamo. Patrick Hamilton said he was struck by how those who are still detained today are experiencing the symptoms of accelerated aging, worsened by the cumulative effects of their experiences and years spent in detention. The senior International Committee of Red Cross official called for detainees to receive adequate mental and physical health care and more frequent family contact, basic rights that US military has brutally refrained to provide for the Guantanamo prisoners. Without elaborating, a Pentagon spokesperson claimed the US Defense Department is currently reviewing the report. Recently, the oldest inmate at Guantanamo, Saifullah Paracha, has been released to his home country of Pakistan after 19 years of detention at Guantanamo. Like most prisoners at Guantanamo, the Pakistani businessman was never formally charged and had little legal power to challenge his detention. The appalling treatment of the foreign captives at Guantanamo came to symbolize the excesses of the purported U.S. war on terror because of harsh interrogation and torture methods widely censured by critics. This is why the U.S. government, which regularly drafts and widely publicizes numerous reports judging and censuring other countries on their human rights observance, has allowed very limited access to the Guantanamo detention facility for international inspectors. Moreover, most Western human rights organizations, such as the British-based Amnesty International and the US-based Human Rights Watch, have kept mostly silent on the horrendous treatment of foreign captives at Guantanamo Bay, as well as foreign refugees, by border guards in the US and other Western countries. The United States and Britain have been key players in the brutal military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and are on record for committing enormous atrocities while occupying the war-torn countries for many years. There were still 40 inmates left in the Guantanamo prison when current US President Joe Biden took office in 2021. The Biden administration has claimed it wants to close the infamous facility, but has never presented a plan for doing so. The previous Democratic administration of Barack Obama also made a similar pledge when Obama was sworn into office in 2008, but also failed to do so. Patrick Hamilton urged Washington to resolve.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer the questions you have regarding the upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, sometimes when our kids are even grown up, but they come up with the problems that are very easy to solve sometimes, and they are not able to resolve those issues. How do we help such kids? Like, how do we make them develop this confidence that they can actually help their problems themselves?
Yes, we find many situations where our children need come crying for help. Whether they are facing an issue at school, or they're facing a bully outside in the neighborhood, or they are facing a difficult situation with their teachers or their peers or their schoolmates, classmates. We need to, you know, help them to resolve that issue on their own. Instead of, you know, becoming stressed ourselves, sometimes we tend to, you know, react and feel that, look, oh, what a great calamity has befallen us and our children. We need to, you make a decision, a knee-jerk decision. You say, okay, I'm coming to school tomorrow. I'm going to take care of that issue.
Yeah.
Or let me come out and see what the person outside is trying to do and bully you. I will hit him. I will do that. No, not at all. That shouldn't be your attitude. That should not be your behavior. You should sit down with him or her.
You don't have to prove that you're a kind of don to prepare to actually be taking a safe side for your friend.
Exactly. You need to sit down your child and talk to him and discuss the issue with him as a friend, and to help him understand what the situation is. If he has or she has carried out something wrong, made a mistake, then we need to teach them how to rectify that mistake.
Yeah.
In their dealing with their children, with their teacher, maybe. The teacher didn't do anything wrong. The child made a wrong decision or made a bad type of gesture or what. That was not acceptable.
Yeah.
And that was not called for. So we need to make him realize that maybe he's making the mistake.
Yeah.
Or even if the other person is in the wrong, then we need to help him sort out the problem and say, look, okay, he's wronged you. You lift yourself to a higher level and say, okay, I will forgive you. I will look over this. I will not, I don't need to react and to return in kind what the other person has done.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hitting back with a stone in reply to a rock or whatever, vice versa. You need to teach them forgiveness. We need to teach them to be patient. We need to teach them to be, have forbearance and to be able to stand up to those issues and to resolve them in a very amicable way. If we need to teach them and manage the conflict, how to manage the conflict.
Yeah.
Conflict management is very important in every type of relationship.
Yeah.
Whether it's between man and wife,
inside
husband and wife.
Family,
it's in family, outside the family. Conflict management
school,
is very important.
In your workplace, yeah.
So we need, instead of, standing up for your child and making him feel that he, whenever he is in a difficult situation, he can fall back on his parents to help him out, then he's not going to achieve self-confidence, is he? He's not going to become a responsible adult in society. He will not be able to face difficult situations. He will not be able to manage those conflicts. So we need to help him in thinking properly, thinking clearly, and this skill to be able to think over things in a very logical, reasonable way is important. This is what we need to teach them.
Yeah.
And how to be able to
manage them.
Manage them and speak out and discuss in a firm way.
Respond to them.
But in a respectful way.
Exactly. Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Till then, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, and Professor is helping us. How do we teach our children to manage conflicts? While talking about conflicts, the quality of our lives depends not on whether or not we have conflicts, but on how we respond to them. And Professor is helping us with some beautiful tips. Yes, Professor.
So as I was saying, we need to help our children to make the proper decisions to react to a situation, which is a difficult situation. Of course, we face this issue where sometimes when you want to make them realize that you made the mistake, they will come back and react and say, oh, all the time you're trying to blame me for the problem.
Yeah.
Instead of blaming the other person, I've come back to you to complain about the other person. The teacher made a wrong, maybe, statement or became angry without any cause or whatever. I want to shift the blame on the other person, and you as a parent are trying to bring that, shift that blame back towards me.
Yeah.
So he feels, you know, the moment you do that, he will become defensive again. So you need to know, break that barrier and start off in a way, look, I'm not trying to blame you. I'm not trying to blame the other person. I just need you to be thinking.
So do you want to say that parents should be neutral over here? They should not be taking any side. They should be neutral and managing
them. Not necessarily, because maybe the person who is either both of them are to blame or one of them is to blame. You can't say, look, everybody's to blame or no one's to blame. But you need to make the child understand.
Analyze the situation
properly.
Yeah.
And make him realize, look, you have to stand with the truth. You have to stand with what is justified. If you should be able to make the decision, I don't want to be judgmental. I'm not passing any observation, making an observation that you're right or your teacher or your schoolmate or classmate, he's wrong. Or it's the other way around. I'm just saying, look, try to analyze what the situation is and try to understand what should have been done. What was the right thing to do? Now, it's up to you to make the decision. If you're right, this is the qualification for being correct, being on the right side. And this is the qualification for being wrong. So explain to him what is right and wrong, and then let him make the decision himself. So that is important.
All right. So,
but still, of course, we need, in another point that we need to point out is he needs to stand up for his rights. There's no doubt about that. He should know what his rights are.
Okay.
As a member of society, at school, at the place of work, my child should know what his rights are, what he should stand up for. But still, there should be also a sense of sacrifice also. If he feels that his rights have been hurt, his rights have been trampled upon, we need to create a sense of, you know, sacrifice also. Yes, you have been wronged, but you should learn how to be more magnanimous. Magnanimity has to be taught.
Exactly. The professor will discuss more things with you, but let's take a short break over here. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Yeah.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, and Professor is helping us how to teach your children to be managing things in the conflicts. Well, Professor, you told us that parents have to be acting very, very wise when it comes to conflicts. When a child especially comes with a complaint to his parents and expecting to be taking his side, be that if it's on a right side, on a wrong side, the important criteria you discussed was over here is that parents should be telling their children to have a fair outlook, giving them the criteria of being on the right side and giving them the criteria of being on the wrong side, and make them themselves make the decision based on the criteria. Where do they actually stand?
Yes, exactly. We need to teach them and educate them and to be able to give them this confidence, self-confidence, that you can make the right decision. If you think properly and control and manage your feelings, you shouldn't have feelings of revenge. It shouldn't be, even if you want to stand up for your rights, if your rights have been trampled upon, if you have been wronged, even then, there shouldn't be this feeling of revenge in you.
All right.
That is important. You need to be patient. You need to don't think of hitting back just because that you feel have been hurt by the wrongdoings of the other person. Yes, you need to be, patient. You need to be, you should take care of the fact that you're not taking it, because you're standing up for what is right.
Mm-hmm.
And what is right is what God has given us. And for whatever is right, whether it pertains to me or to any other one, any other person, it's a God-given right.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to stand up for that God-given right, even if it concerns me also. Whether it's me or it's for others, it's for the sake of Allah.
Yeah.
And it's the sake for the sake of the love of Allah, not my own loving myself and, just
my
for my own sake. It's for Allah. If Allah has given me the right, then I have to stand up for it based on a sincere feeling of love.
Yeah.
And it's not the hatred, because he especially if he's a human being, a mu'min, a faithful person, is my brother, is my a part of the family, is a part of the Muslim society, even a human being. And then I need to, seek justice for myself and for others based on the God-given rights that I have. So this is important, that it should not be for the sake of revenge. It should not be for the sake of cooling down and satisfying my ego as it is.
Yeah. Those were really helpful advices that you could have been giving to the parents to help their children be with dealing with the conflicts, because most of the times parents, especially the mothers, are very, very emotional and they feel like they should be taking the side of their children. But you have actually made things very clear that to teach to be even yourself and also teach your children to be on the very right and fair side in the conflicts and learn to manage them. And violence is also always not the solution of the conflict. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. That's all the time we had for today. Thank you so much, dear listeners. And if you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab, COI, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs over there. You can also listen to our small clips on the social media platforms by typing Call of Islam. Thanks so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.